Hello, and welcome to episode 89 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I'm Nick Soutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Jamie Elder, postdoctoral fellow at the Black Hole Initiative at Harvard University. Jamie's current research concerns the methodology and epistemology of large astrophysical experiments, especially those including the LIGO-Virgo gravitational wave detectors and the Event Horizon Telescope that involve observing black holes. Much of her work concerns how models and simulations are embedded in experimental methods and what epistemic implications this has for making inferences about astrophysical target systems. At the Black Hole Initiative, Jamie organizes the Foundation Seminar, bringing together philosophers and scientists to discuss foundational issues in physics and astronomy. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Jamie. Dr. Jamie Elder, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this Wednesday afternoon?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. It's really great to be here.
Thanks so much for taking the time, especially after what I imagine for both of us has been quite the past weekend with the Philosophy of Science Association meeting. Before we hopped on, we were discussing a little bit about that. And Jamie, I hear you had the opportunity to come to Pittsburgh and attend and present. How was the meeting for you?
It was great. I mean, it was so wonderful to be at the PSA after, you know, the last few years of not having conferences like that, seeing all my philosophy of science friends, seeing lots of great talks. I presented with my co-author, Yulia Stabachevsky, on philosophy of LIGO and the EHT. So lots of black hole stuff, which was really fun.
Exciting. And was it in a philosophy, I imagine, a philosophy of physics special session of some kind?
Yeah, I think the session was philosophy of physics, astronomy or astrophysics and cosmology, something like that. So there was a nice mix of talks sort of spanning what you might imagine falls under that category, that quite broad category.
Understandable. And yeah, very much so about it. It's been quite a tough time for conferences and things. I know we've done electronic versions and over Zoom, but I felt like this conference was almost like a homecoming of sorts to bring philosophers of science back. A lot of people returning on Twitter saying this is like one of the best they've had in years. And I think you had mentioned, I didn't know this, that they essentially had doubled their capacity, their expected capacity in terms of attendance. So that's a very exciting
And I think everybody was just so excited to be there in person and seeing everyone after so long. It was
I know.
Really great atmosphere.
It made me feel really excited for just like future connections and endeavors. And it shows just how much this discipline is a social discipline in many respects, and very interested in others' work. And yeah, so I'm very happy. Any memorable moments at the conference other than your talk?
There was a really cool session on the philosophy of astrochemistry that I went to.
Oh, interesting.
That was really cool. I mean, astrochemistry is not something that you hear that much about. It's sort of a new emerging field in philosophy of science. And so there was a sort of a session on sort of George Smith started with his work on closing the loop. Nora Boyd talked a little bit about some astrophysical examples and what you do in the case of anomalies, and there were some astrochemists there. And then Marie Guigan, I'm probably mispronouncing her name, she was the organizer of the session, and so she sort of brought it all together at the end, and it was really cool.
Very exciting. Yeah, I know Nora Boyd is on philosophy of chemistry and others, and so it's interesting to see this connection of I imagine philosophy of astronomy or physics and astrochemistry coming together. So I definitely saw on the panel a number of different subspecialties of philosophy of science that I hadn't seen before, that I'm sure have been around, but are kind of new. For example, nutrition sciences was there, and memory was there again. So yeah, it's been great to see a number of things. So, well, I'm glad you enjoyed that talk. So where, so you're currently at the Black Hole Initiative at Harvard, is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
The
first interdisciplinary center for the study of black holes.
Wow. that's so I'm sure we'll talk more about your research later on, but yeah, tell us about what goes on at this center? How have things been?
It's a center that brings together people from philosophy, physics, astronomy, maths, history, really anyone who's interested in black holes. And so we come together for talks and you've got people from all these different disciplines in the room, having good conversations and collaborating. And it's a really, for me, it's a really fun atmosphere to be in.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I'm happy to hear about it. I'd love to hear more about, what kind of projects you're working on there and the kind of collaboration that happens as well. But before we get into the center, let's take a step back and learn a little bit about you, Jamie, as a researcher and as a person. So tell us, Jamie, where did you grow up?
It's a simple question with a complicated answer. I grew up in both Canada and New Zealand. My father's originally from New Zealand and my mother's originally from Canada. So I was born in New Zealand and moved to Canada when I was 3 months old and then moved back when I was 10 and then didn't leave until I was 22 for graduate school.
That is an interesting answer and complicated. So if I can understand correctly, had some early years in Canada until yes. about age 10 and then some more formative years in New Zealand proper.
Yeah. So in many ways, I feel more like a New Zealander, but I sound more like a Canadian.
Yeah, I guess I could. I can get behind that. So tell us a little bit about. So what kinds of things were you interested in growing up? And I suppose this is the first time I've seen this shift between kind of midway through development or just in growing up. Like, what were things like? What was the transition like?
The transition between Canada and New Zealand?
Yeah.
It was tough, but it was also kind of an exciting and fun thing to experience. I think it gave me early on a sort of appreciation for just, even within two countries that are quite culturally similar, just how different things can be. I got to school for the first time in New Zealand and had a spelling test and I couldn't spell any of the words because I couldn't even figure out what the teacher was saying.
Okay. Well, that's quite a cultural difference, or just unique experience. Back to the first question before I asked about the transition, but yeah, what kinds of things, did you find yourself interested in?
I've always had pretty broad interests, but I've also been obsessed with space forever. Right from childhood, that was the part of like the science books that I was always really excited about. And I think I read Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time when I was really too young to understand it properly, I'm sure. But, when I was 12 or something like that. And I've sort of been obsessed with black holes ever since. You know, I wrote my middle school essays on black holes. I gave a speech on a black hole for a speech and drama class once. So it's perhaps not surprising I put the Black Hole Initiative.
I'm so happy. No, this is so exciting. I can share in the affinity for space growing up, even though that's eventually not what I came to research. There's just something fascinating about there. It's undeniably fascinating. I was actually up. I found myself waking up slightly last night to watch the launch. I don't know if you happened to see it. It happened at like 2 a.m. or something like that. But
yeah. 2 a.m. was kind of a deal breaker for me, but
it was just, what I found fascinating was that it happened. And it was just unexpected. And I know it had been delayed. Like it was originally had been scheduled for a couple weeks back. And I remember that was sort of disappointing. So I think they just, whatever it just did, but I caught it happening. But yeah, I think there was like 150,000 continuous views of the launch, which just shows like the excitement for space, regardless of things. So what's interesting to me also, so what was it like being interested in space in Canada and New Zealand in terms of, you know, discussing their, like, what was the, so I'm curious about, like, excitement for either space programs or connection to one or the other, or was this more of just like a general interest in black holes in space separate from, you know, a mode of or a method of study via certain things?
I mean, I think my first interest in space, as for many people, comes from just looking up at the stars. And yeah. I'm sort of lucky enough to have come from two places where I spent a lot of time looking at the stars from locations where there wasn't too much pollution. There wasn't too much light pollution in particular, and where you really could see a lot. And I think also with the transition from Canada to New Zealand, seeing how different the stars looked from those different locations. So, I mean, things like constellations just being sort of flipped and down in New Zealand, and your perspective on things looks totally different.
Yeah.
That was quite an interesting experience. But I mean, some of the places that I spend a lot of my time in New Zealand have such good visibility that you sort of walk out on a dry summer evening and you just see the Milky Way spread out in front of you, and you see the Magellanic Clouds, and it's a really easy way, I think, to get enthusiastic about the stars.
Well, absolutely. Were there any observatories nearby where you grew up, or ones that you would travel to?
I didn't travel there until I was doing my first astrophysics course at the University of Canterbury, where in Christchurch, New Zealand, where I'm from. But there's actually a region in New Zealand that's a sort of light pollution protection zone. They've got really strict rules about the kinds of light and the kinds of things you can have there. And there's in the center of that, there's an observatory on Mount John. So in the first year of my undergrad, we went on a trip down there and got to sort of tour the observatory and look through some of the telescopes.
That sounds wonderful. It's tough to grow up in a city where you don't see the stars too often, or when you do, they're not particularly spectacular from your vantage point. But it is something to really go to a protected area of sorts in a region, and or just happen to be up in the mountains and be able to see the stars.
I was just going to say, I remember being at a philosophy of physics summer school in Europe and pointing up to the stars and pointing at a satellite. And, you know, one of the people I was with had lived their whole life in Europe and places where you don't have good views of the stars. And at first they didn't believe me. They didn't believe that you could see satellites. This is definitely a thing.
Yeah. I go up to northern Montana, or actually it's southern Montana, but it's essentially north enough. And you can see, any night sky, you might count dozens of satellites. Oh, there's one. Oh, there's one. Yeah. But it's all about getting out into, a clear vantage. So at the time, like, what, you were fascinated by black holes. What kinds of questions did you have about them?
I mean, I think I was just fascinated by the idea that there was this sort of point of no return, and that we didn't know what was beyond it, and that we couldn't know what was beyond it unless we decided to be very brave and throw ourselves into one. And I think in general, I've always just been fascinated by the idea that, in general relativity, it's common to think of space and time as being curved. And so gravity is this manifestation of the curvature of space-time. And there's something, in my mind's eye that's sort of visually fascinating about the idea of space-time being stretched and bent and curved and in such a strong way around a black hole, the sort of warping that happens, that I was really fascinated by that idea. I think, Stephen Hawking used that metaphor of a bowling ball on a trampoline. And I just, you know, I just thought that was so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I must admit it. I also would agree. So with carrying on with your fascination with black holes. So So in terms of, did you plan to want to study? Did you want to be do physics proper or theoretical physics, astronomy? Like, what were some ideas around maybe turning this into like a profession?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to do so many things when I was my undergraduate level. You know, part of me wanted to be an English professor. Part of me wanted to be an astrophysicist. I could have gone a lot of different ways, I think. And I started out in my undergrad. I mean, I started out actually in civil engineering, doing civil engineering. No, not civil engineering.
Oops. Oh, sorry, I lost you for 1 second.
I actually had a quantum mechanics course that was scheduled to start halfway through an early modern philosophy course. And so I was having to choose between the two. And so I went to the early modern philosophy professor and I was like, look, I'd really want to take your class, but there's this quantum mechanics course that I feel I have to do. Would it be okay if I sat in for just the first half of your classes out of interest? And he was like, oh, you're doing philosophy and physics? Have you considered doing philosophy of physics? And at that point, I'd never even heard of philosophy of physics. I didn't know it was a thing. It sort of always seemed natural to me that these were two sides of the same coin, that they're sort of both methods of trying to understand the sort of deep fundamental nature of the universe. But I didn't realize that they were sort of institutionally combinable. And then I think from then on, that was it.
All right, fair enough. So this was already in undergraduate study. So you began your study at Cambridge, is that right?
Sorry?
Or did you start, in terms of sort of university study, so you went, is it that you went to Cambridge, is that right?
Well, I did my undergrad in New Zealand
at the
University of Canterbury. And then after that, I went and did a master's at Cambridge in philosophy before I went to Notre Dame for my PhD.
Right. Right. Okay. Fair enough. So, wow. So the direct path. I must say, it's interesting trying to be in English. I feel like if you have to like writing, if you want to do philosophy in some way, like you have to have some affinity or connection with writing if you really want to get into philosophy in some way. But I'm happy to see this connection between the two. So it sounds like you found philosophy physics at Canterbury in undergrad. What took you then to Cambridge in terms of doing like a master's? And I imagine, was it history and philosophy of science or philosophy?
The master was actually in philosophy. At the point when I was applying for grad school from New Zealand, I honestly didn't even know that HPS was a thing. So I didn't even think to apply to Cambridge HPS, although, you know, in some ways, you know, knowing what I know now, it probably would have been a better fit. But I'm actually really glad that I did the philosophy master's at Cambridge, because then, of course, when I went to do a whole bunch of other coursework at Notre Dame, and my sort of master's going through there was HPS. And so I've sort of got a balance of the two things.
Yeah.
Which is the only real reason I ended up in HPS at Notre Dame is that I was emailing with Catherine Brading, who's then at Notre Dame, and Don Howard and others. And I think it was Catherine who emailed me back and was like, well, you're interested in philosophy of physics and you're applying to Notre Dame. You should apply to Notre Dame HPS. And I think it was only a few days before the deadline, but I
That. Wonderful. Well, and so was there any discussion? So in terms of doing a master, like how, so you, perhaps you can speak to this. How have you seen, you know, doing a master's in the UK or an MPhil and then going to the US or North America to do a, you know, an extended PhD, essentially an extended PhD, like a 5-year PhD, like, Do you think, I mean, was there any ever thought of, you know, trying to, or decide, you know, do completing the PhD at Cambridge, or, you know, was there a sense that, what went into the thought there?
Yeah. You know, they're such different systems. And I think that for me, I'd done a lot more physics in my undergraduate really than I'd done philosophy, even though I was a philosophy major. And I think that, you know, the philosophy masters at Cambridge was really good for learning how to write papers and for sort of doing your own thing. But I still felt like I had so much just to learn about philosophy and about the history of science. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really glad that I decided to go to the US, and especially to a program like Notre Dame, where I got such broad coursework in history and philosophy of science. You know, I think some people would have been ready to go straight into a PhD after the master's that I did at Cambridge, but I don't think I was. I had a lot of learning still to do.
Sure. I appreciate that answer. And it is always a challenge, because if you do come from, even if you technically major in philosophy or something in undergrad, perhaps your focus is more in a science, and it's not really in capturing, like, just having feeling like the full breadth of and depth of, like, the disciplinary approach. And so I think I'm there with you. And if I imagine for folks who don't do, and maybe would take the path of continuing on in a DPhil or something like that, you know, they might end up needing to catch up anyway with, you know, once they get the job. I've spoken with many people who, you know, once they get the job, then feel like they need to catch up with the philosophy to kind of keep up with their other colleagues, or just feel kind of more connected with them.
I think that people who start in the British system typically are more concentrated much earlier on, whereas the American system tends to be much broader earlier on. And so, you know, I think that a lot of people going into that master's had already done a lot more philosophy than I had. And, you know, it just depends where you're coming from and what your strengths and weaknesses are. It's always a sort of a trade-off between breadth and depth, I think.
Right. So, getting into Notre Dame, I'm familiar with their HPS program. I've talked to many people who've gone in there. I don't think any philosophers of physics, though. So, yeah, what was your experience like in graduate study, and how did it change or shape the way you think about and approach research on black holes?
So, I think that the Notre Dame HPS program is a little different from, say, the Pittsburgh program, or from other programs, in that it's kind of halfway. It's not its own department. You're an HPS student, but you also have your home department in philosophy or history. And so, at least when I was going through, you had to meet all of the philosophy department requirements, and then all of the additional HPS requirements, which meant that you got a really broad range of courses. You know, you had to do a bunch of history and philosophy. You had to do a bunch of straight history of science. And having never done any history courses, actually, in my undergrad, going straight into graduate history courses was certainly a learning curve. You know, historians read in a very different way than philosophers do. And so it was certainly challenging. But I really appreciate now having had the exposure to so many different disciplinary perspectives for studying science, both, you know, history of science, but also some SDS. You know, I know I certainly am not a historian or an SDS person. You know, I'm certainly not qualified to do those, do those approaches myself. But I feel like I've got enough of an understanding to sort of appreciate what they're doing there, which is really helpful.
Yeah, I think that's generally it's pretty hard to do both really successfully. But I think focusing a discipline in one or the other, while still being able to appreciate and understand where the other is coming from, is a significant accomplishment, I think. Does Notre Dame's, do they take just more like historians of science kind of proper, like where who they end up doing more of a history dissertation as opposed to like a philosophy dissertation?
Yeah, so they have three different tracks. There's the philosophy track, a history track, and a theology and science track, because the Notre Dame theology department, at least one of, if not the sort of strongest theology programs in North America. And so, yeah, you have, you know, people within your cohort or within the program who are really fully trained historians, and they might describe as like Americanist historians or, you know, whatever kind of history focused disciplinary categories they would apply to themselves, as well as being like a historian of medicine. Right. And so you end up taking classes with these people and you're sort of both struggling through each other's disciplines together, which I think is, you know, kind of fun.
Is there like a theology of physics? are there folks that you met when who were on the theology track that would take interest in your work or others?
The theology and science track is certainly smaller. The person who was in classes with me, it was in my cohort, Michelle Marvin, she focused on spiritual identity, mm-hmm. and how it changes with brain injury or memory loss. So it was really at this intersection of sort of, I guess, cognitive science, psychology, and theology. Quite far afield from what I do, right. But very interesting stuff.
That's fascinating. I saw someone at the PSA this year who was doing like a theology of, he had a poster and he was at UC Irvine, but it was, I think it had to do with the scientific study of religion or theology, which is not really, it's not religious studies though. It's separate. And so it sounds like kind of a similar when you have these like interesting intersection of fields. So no, that's interesting. And I must imagine, yeah, it must have been something to kind of be around within these other courses. Or with these other folks who are taking the similar courses with you. So, okay. So it sounds like the HPS program at Notre Dame, there's not the same single department, different tracks, different exposure to different, approaches and disciplines. So walk me through, like, how did your ideas around, you know, deciding the dissertation topic, what did you end up coming to go about saying and doing for the dissertation?
Yeah, so, you know, I think one of the sort of pivotal moments for me in figuring out what I was going to do for my dissertation was going to Seven Pines, which is this sort of invite-only, physics and philosophy thing that they do in Minnesota every year, and I don't really know how to describe it aside from this, just kind of this very small, intense workshop on a particular topic. And Don Howard, my advisor, brought me along that year because the theme was black holes in the spotlight. And there was somebody there from LIGO talking a little bit about some of their very early detections, because at that point they just made a few. And I think that was the real turning point in me moving away a little bit from sort of the previous interests I'd had in thinking about black holes from, you know, more of a traditional philosophy of physics perspective, you know, thinking about, say, the information loss paradox, and moving more towards trying to understand the observational or experimental side of it. You know, how is it that we get an empirical grasp on something like a black hole that's far away, that doesn't emit light, that's just very elusive in many ways. And so my dissertation project ended up being focused on LIGO, but from the perspective of trying to understand the methodology and the epistemology of those, the detection of gravitational waves and the subsequent inferences you can make with those, you know, observing black holes, and indeed neutron stars.
Yeah, tell us about LIGO.
So the LIGO, or now the LIGO Virgo Kagra collaboration. Essentially, they are a collaboration with a network of gravitational wave interferometers. So what those are L-shaped instruments for detecting gravitational waves, and they're scattered around the globe. And when a gravitational wave passes, it causes the length of the arms of the interferometers to wiggle back, wiggle back and forth. And then you get a signal. And then, because when you have signals from multiple detectors around the Earth, it enables you to sort of construct a lot of reconstruct a lot of information about the gravitational waves themselves, but also the sources of the gravitational waves. And so you can make inferences about, in most cases, the sources will be binary black hole mergers. So that's when you have two black holes, they're orbiting around each other increasingly quickly and eventually merge into one another and form a single black hole. And so those are really highly energetic events, which means that they produce really strong gravitational waves that are able to be detected on Earth. And so my dissertation was looking at various philosophically interesting aspects of what LIGO, the LIGO-Virgo at that point collaboration, is actually doing in order to make these detections. So one of the chapters was looking at, they described this as the first direct detection of gravitational waves. One of my papers is just looking at what could they possibly mean by that? You know, there's a clear contrast case with earlier so-called indirect detections via the observation of binary pulsars. But really getting into the nitty gritty of saying what separates the two cases turns out to be, you know, quite a subtle thing.
Interesting. Yeah, I know you mentioned that, you know, somewhat your work works on, in scare quotes, observing black holes. So what, so it sounds like this is kind of, especially when you're calling something direct or indirect observation, mm-hmm. Description or measurement. So tell us a little bit more about that. What do we mean by observing the black holes?
Yeah, so observing is one of these words in philosophy of science that's a little bit controversial. But usually, I mean, if it's astrophysics, observation is never going to be, or it's at least very rarely going to be, ordinary sense perception. But instead, it's going to be something like a measurement using a telescope or some other kind of instrument, and then some inference based on that data about some kind of distant target system. And in the case of gravitational waves, the gravitational waves are right there. But similarly, it's going to be really a measurement, an instrumental measurement that's being classed as an observation. And when it comes to whether something is direct or not, I think that actually these words get used in a lot of different ways. But when I think about the direct detection of gravitational waves, the way that I think they should be distinguished is in terms of essentially an understanding of how the measurement works and our modelment of the measurement process. So for LIGO, they're detecting using gravitational wave interferometers, and the data that's output from those instruments actually is a representation of the gravitational waves. There's a lot of further data analysis that goes into it, but it is at least a representation of the strain of the gravitational wave, versus in the case of the Hulse-Taylor observations of binary pulsars, they're using radio telescopes to essentially get timestamps of when pulses are coming. And so their data really isn't about gravitational waves. And there's a lot more, there's many further inferences that are required in order to turn it into data about gravitational waves. And those inferences rely on models of a distant target system, specifically the binary pulsar system. And, you know, while being a direct detection, like in LIGO, doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be epistemically better. It does mean that the kinds of justification you give for your confidence in your detection are going to be a bit different, because In the LIGO case, you're not relying on a model of a distant target system. You're just relying on your understanding and your modeling of your instrument itself. And so that's sort of the key epistemic difference I see in that case. But it's interesting to think about the extent to which that distinction maps onto other kinds of experiments.
Physics experiments or things even outside of,
even just physics experiments. I mean,
sure,
I think
sure. Yeah.
People talk about direct observation in particle physics. They mean
right.
something
That's
quite
what
different.
I was thinking. Right, right. So what did you find? Perhaps could you, I think I'm getting at what's the importance. What I hear about is what's obviously important kind of in general is like what kinds of inferences we can draw depends on the kind of the way, I suppose how these kind of detections or observations are represented. And depending on what we see, that's how much we can kind of gather, like depending on how we think about them could be influencing the way in which we qualify or give weight to our inferences in regard to this. So yeah, is there something special though about like looking at observations in the case of these large astrophysical experiments in separate from, these questions about, for example, other experiments in physics, like in particle physics, where the system of detection is, farther away and we're not getting this. So yeah, what is kind of unique and special about asking these kinds of epistemological and methodological questions in your cases?
So I think that there are, astrophysics in some ways has a lot in common with physics in terms of the kinds of challenges. But in other ways, it has a lot in common with, say, historical sciences like paleontology. And so I think that understanding, what astrophysicists are doing requires a combination of different kinds of analogies and different kinds of comparisons with sciences that you might not think have that much to do with one another. And so one thing I've been thinking a lot about recently is this, to what extent the comparison with other historical sciences is a useful lens for thinking about the methodology of astrophysics. And, I'm inclined to think that it is quite an apt comparison, especially once. So my dissertation was mostly focused on just initial detections and observations of
direct detection. Right.
Yeah. But when you move beyond that and you LIGO has all of these detections now, they have this whole population of black holes that they've observed. The next question is, what are the properties of the population of black holes? And what are the sort of causal pathways that lead to having the black hole mergers that you actually observe? And so then what does this sort of history of black holes in the universe look like, essentially? And, you're trying to make inferences about that based on a single snapshot at the end of these black holes' life in combination with information from not gravitational wave astrophysics, but other kinds of astrophysics, other kinds of sort of lines of evidence we have about black holes. And, it's a really difficult task in part because we don't have controlled experiments in astrophysics. We have lots of simulations where we can try and figure out plausible formation channels for black holes. But, the empirical evidence is fairly limited to certain snapshots. And so I think it's interesting to make comparisons between sort of that and say inferences from a fossil record. What are the similarities? What are the differences between what astrophysicists are doing and what, say, a geologist or a paleontologist or an archaeologist is doing?
So I just have had a few episodes ago on discuss with Adrian Curry. Not you familiar with the philosopher of science who does philosophy of I guess, paleontology. I mean, he basically focuses on the historical sciences, paleontology, archaeology, geology, and he seems to be a pretty big optimist when it comes to uncovering the deep past and the epistemic resources we have. And so, yeah, I'm really fascinated by this, by the comparisons you're considering making. And it sounds like this is kind of an ongoing project, but, what is your inclination, I guess, as of now? Do you think something like astrophysics, do we want to consider in some way astrophysics as a historical, like the detection of some of these things? Like, should it be a historical science? Are there more similarities between doing this kind of work in astrophysics than with these other historical sciences than perhaps differences? What do you think?
I mean, I think in a very literal sense, astronomy is a historical science, right? Yeah. Because when you're observing distant events, you're observing them as they were a long time ago. Right. You're always getting this sort of downstream, causally downstream, you know, photons or gravitational waves that are just sort of the remnants of something very long ago. And when you look further and back into the universe, you're looking further and further back in time. But from a methodological standpoint, I think that they're, you know, I'm hesitant to try and say whether it's more like a historical science or more like, experimental physics. I think there's good comparisons with both. But I think that there are certainly some really strong, I do think that the historical science lens is a nice one for understanding what astrophysicists are up to. And I think it's one that actually astrophysicists themselves often invoke when describing what they're doing.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm happy to hear. Well, I'm interested, I would say, to hear that about, the way, I guess, yeah, just classifying, it sounds like astrophysicists actually do quite a lot.
Yeah, and it would be, I'm a big fan of Adrian Curry's book, and it would be really nice to make the same kind of optimistic case for astrophysics as he makes for other historical sciences.
Sure. Well, tell us the story about how you got into this black hole initiative, because I hadn't heard of this. I'm sure if I was more in the philosophy of physics, I probably would have heard of it. But yeah, it sounds like a fascinating center and connection with a number of different folks exploring black holes and come from a variety of different methodologies. So how did you get connected with this initiative, and what is sort of expected of you as a postdoc and a researcher there to undertake? What's the intellectual life like there?
Yeah, so I guess I started visiting the Black Hole Initiative, or BHI, a few years before I was a postdoc there. They have an annual conference that brings together people from, they have invited speakers from lots of different disciplines talking about black holes. And so I was, really excited when they had advertised a postdoc there that included philosophers.
Right. Yeah.
And, so I was at the point where I was finishing up my dissertation and not knowing what was coming next, full anxiety of the job market and applying for, everything at the same time as trying to finish. And so, I could not have been more thrilled when I got the news that I'd got the postdoc there. And unfortunately, I moved there in fall of 2020. So my first year was a little bit different. We weren't allowed to go into the office. Everything was on Zoom. And for the kind of place that the BHI is, you do lose a lot from that, mm-hmm. because so much of it is just about running into people in the hallway, getting drawn into conversations with astronomers, just having a real sense of what people are working on and collaborating on. But fortunately, in the last couple of years, as things have opened up again, I've been able to get much more of a taste of that. And it's even sort of, you know, we have a weekly seminar, or a weekly colloquium. We invite speakers from different disciplines, from physics, from astronomy, math, philosophy. And so that's a place where everybody shows up, including the, you know, the bigwig PIs, the postdoc students, even some undergraduate students. And we all just come together for these talks that are usually outside most people's discipline,
right?
Just by the numbers. And I think that's a really valuable opportunity for everyone to sort of gain some kind of competency in fields outside their own, and being able to ask questions and get a sense of what's going on in those other fields. And then sort of also on Mondays, I organize the foundation seminar. So we invite speakers in to talk about issues at the intersection of physics and philosophy and astronomy. And so that's actually pretty well attended by some of the physicists and astronomers as well. Overall, between those sort of formal structures and just the more informal meetings and hallways, sharing, getting lunch, getting coffee. I think it's a really special place if you're interested in black holes, because, you know, everybody shares that obsession, even if they're studying it from very different angles.
So, I mean, yeah. So obviously I'm sure, yes, there, a line came up for a postdoc with philosophy. And I noticed that it seems like, is the center director a philosopher?
So Peter Gallison, who's a philosopher and historian of science. He's the current head of the BHI. So even though there's not that many of us at the BHI, we get a good showing.
Right. You get somebody in charge, or at least big representative. I'm thrilled that, I'm thrilled that you're here and having this experience. In terms of connecting with other scientists, or, you know, kind of there, I imagine there's, astrophysicists, astronomers, do you find yourself, you know, chatting with them, reading their papers, or, you know, how does interacting with, other scientists in physics and astronomy, either connect with your work or connect with your, additional just interests in things as well? Maybe not necessarily impacting your work.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is conversations, after the talks, over dinner. I mean, one example I can think of recently is I was writing a paper for a philosophy of astrophysics volume that's being put together, and so I was thinking about the nature of theory testing in, especially, gravitational wave astrophysics, but and astrophysics more broadly. And because I'd spent time at the BHI talking to some of the PIs there, especially you know, Priya, who works on like the seeds for black holes. And but what I mean by that is really what the sort of origin story of a black hole is. What are the sort of formation channels what explains the black holes that we actually observe? And so because I'd heard her talking about this and I'd had conversations with her about it, I ended up reading some of her papers and then some of the sort of related literature. And so I ended up incorporating that kind of example into a paper that could have otherwise just been more about theory testing on the, so half the paper is theory testing about individual black holes, but half the paper is much more of this sort of kind of historical lens, thinking about, you know, how those black holes got to be there in the first place. And so I think that's the kind of literature that I just might not really have been on my radar if I hadn't been spending time at the BHI talking to people there.
Harrison, no, I'm thrilled to hear these kind of stories of connection. So, I mean, that's exactly, I imagine, what the initiative is all about as well, or like part of the initiative is bringing folks together to inform. So what are some, for your own research, perhaps, what are some outstanding questions that you might hope to explore either at the BHI or beyond, as a philosopher of physics, as a philosopher of astrophysics, related to, either black holes or more methodology or models, modeling in astrophysics?
That's a big question.
Or just one question, like one maybe your thing. I mean, I know you mentioned about, I love this comparison to the historical sciences, and perhaps, you know, if that's kind of the next focus, that's great. You know, that's, but yeah, I mean, I'm not in philosophy of physics, but I'm fascinated by like what kinds of things that, are keeping those folks up, you folks up at night, and or what, how, yeah, what's, you know, kind of what are some future directions, that people are looking toward?
Okay, so one thing that I'm particularly interested in right now is, you know, how we might get hints of, if not the sort of, to put it one way, the breakdown of general relativity in terms of its descriptions of black holes. And so in gravitational wave astrophysics, you have LIGO, Virgo, Kagra testing GR with binary black hole mergers. Many of my colleagues at the BHI work on the Event Horizon Telescope, and now the next generation Event Horizon Telescope too. And that, you've probably seen the pictures of the black holes that they produced.
It was pretty recently, right? I think there was yeah, so I feel like black holes have been in the news in the past few years. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are some of the people I work with worked on those pictures.
Wow.
And so one of the things that I'm interested in is moving forward, what does theory testing look like in that context? Because it's certainly not the kind of straightforward theory testing that you get in a sort of simplistic notion of science where you set up your experiment and you have a prediction of how it's going to go and you look for the differences. And part of the reason for that is the way that the theory itself is sort of implicated in a lot of the observation and inference of these black holes. And so one thing I've been trying to understand is if we're looking for places that, or hints of a theory beyond GR, whether that be some new classical theory or whether it be some kind of quantum gravitational theory, where are the likely breaking points? Where are the likely hints going to come? And in what ways do the methods being used by astrophysicists at the moment sort of either have the potential to sort of mask those hints with theory, the sort of theory ladenness of the observations, or to what extent are they really trying to maximize their openness to seeing those hints? And so that's something I'm interested in the moment.
No, that's fascinating. So by hints, you just mean like notable points of evidence or data that could suggest a revision of theory?
So all of our observations so far have been consistent with general relativity. They've all been in good agreement with the predictions of general relativity. But there are plenty of reasons to think that general relativity is not a final theory. It's some kind of effective theory that needs to be maybe combined with quantum physics in deeper ways. And so maybe there's issues about singularities that might make you think that at some point general relativity has to break down. But so far we haven't seen any real sort of observational evidence that points us in a clear way about what that successor theory is likely to look like or what kind of observational consequences it might have. And so I think, you know, astrophysics is a way of observing situations that we cannot replicate here on Earth. And so the hope I think that many astronomers have is that we might be able to observe something that would
pretty exciting. Yeah.
Kind of some kind of anomaly, some kind of new phenomena that would give us some kind of clue.
But so part of perhaps philosophers' jobs or the hope is to work out sort of the nature of like what kinds of, well, to the nature of like what those things kind of could look like or what. Yeah. So explain a little bit more about where, if we're looking for those kinds of things, what kinds of questions do philosophy of physics need to help settle on in terms of those things?
Yeah. So this actually ties in a little bit with my PSA talk, to go sort of full circle.
Perfect.
So in that talk, Julius and I were discussing both LIGO and the EHT and the senses in which the use of especially simulations within the observational process lead to different kinds of theory latentness within the process. You know, theory, right, relations, and observations are very much intertwined in this context.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And for some purposes, that looks pretty unproblematic. For some purposes, it looks like at least a major challenge that needs to be overcome, because it does have the potential to really bias results if left unchecked.
Yeah.
Now, I think astronomers are very aware of this, but to understand what they're doing, I think you need to understand the challenges that they're up against. And one of those, I think, is the sort of inescapable theory latentness of some of these observations.
Now, are these kinds of theory, is this kind of theory latentness, do you think, apparent in other historical sciences? To make that kind of comparison?
I think it certainly is, although I suspect that in other historical sciences, you know, so Adrian Curry talks about the mid-range theories that are connecting the trace with the sort of target of mm-hmm. that you're trying to understand. And so my suspicion is that in most historical sciences, those mid-range theories look very different from the kinds of theories describing the target system itself. You know, something like process of fossilization is very different from the thing you're trying to learn about, say, dinosaurs. In astrophysics, it's sometimes the case, and this is the case for observations of black holes with LIGO, that the very same theory tends to be implicated in a lot of different ways and a lot of parts. And so when you're observing black holes with LIGO, everything is going to be described by GR. Your theory of gravitational waves uses right. GR, or theory of black holes uses GR. And so the same, the sort of mid-range theory connecting the target system to the eventual data is the same theory you're trying to test. And so I think that's maybe one disanalogy, or it's one way when related yeah. to theory latentness and maybe okay. other historical sciences do.
Thank you for that. Okay, I know we're about done. Let me follow up with that final question. What do you take to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
That's another big question. I think what I'll talk about here is maybe what I find was challenging Perfect. In doing philosophy of science, which is that I think that doing responsible philosophy of science, on the one hand, requires really careful engagement with the science, and that, you know, when you look at some of these cases, they're very complicated. There's a lot of details, and a lot of what you want to say philosophically depends pretty on some pretty detailed stuff about the way that the science is working. It requires a very detailed knowledge of what's going on. But on the other hand, I think philosophers are sort of in the business of trying to make more general claims about the nature of science. And, you know, to say as much as we can helpful things or insightful things that apply as broadly as possible. And I think, you know, the discipline, you see increasing specialization. You know, we're all, you know, at the PSA, it's like a lot of the talks, it's just the philosophers of physics going to the philosophy of physics talks, and the philosophers of biology going to the philosophy of biology talks. at the same time, we're trying to say something more general about science without being sort of isolated in our little silos. And I think that's a real challenge because there's just so much to know, and it's trying to get breadth, trying to get depth at the same time. I mean, I think ultimately there's lots of good ways to do philosophy. And I hope we can continue to talk to each other and build bridges between those two.
I hope so too. All right, Jamie. Well, thank you so much for taking some time to chat. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for sharing about your research and answering the tough questions, of which we've discussed a few. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm glad to hear you're back from PSA and had a good time. And yeah, it was wonderful to talk. And hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks, Jamie.
Have a good rest of your day.
You too. Take care.